Welcome back to the Wildside News. And now, Sidney Wildsmith.
General Motors announced that it must downsize its workforce by 125,000 workers. That corporate bubble is bursting, and some say it could have been avoided had carmakers heeded the many warnings over the last 35 years about oil and limits. But alas, it's a lot too late. Help celebrate Fossil Fools Day this Saturday and learn about it and more when your Voice of the Earth continues here on the Wildside News. Everybody's talking about it, global warming. So many took it for granted. But apparently things are changing, and no place faster and more passionately than on college campuses across the nation. We head back east, and we meet Billy Parrish, who is turning a lot of minds around the vision that it's up to the current crop of college kids to take control of their destiny or be drowned in the ocean of change headed our way.
As we look to this emerging new century, this is going to play out for different people in a lot of different ways. And I think the people who really are paying attention to some of these serious issues, particularly the global warming issue, are those who are younger than I am, because they're going to have to live with it for a lot longer, possibly even into the next century. Someone who's very involved in bringing that message forward to his very specific generation, that is to say people who are in college right now, is a gentleman named Billy Parrish. Billy, welcome to the Wildside News.
Thanks, Sidney.
You've been involved in environmental things for quite some time. Why don't you tell me how it is that these issues have become of such importance to you?
I've been a full-time student global warming organizer for almost 4 years. And I got interested in the work my junior year in high school at a school called the Mountain School in Vermont, which is a one-semester program on an organic farm in Vermont. And I grew up in New York City, so it was my first real introduction to nature and to environmental role models and a few books that really sort of raised my awareness about the problems that we face and that especially face young people.
What was it about that experience that stands out as a kind of a transitional moment for you?
One night I was reading a book called Ishmael by Daniel Quinn. In the book, he describes our civilization as a craft going off of a cliff. We believe that we're flying, and until people begin to look down and realize that our civilization is in free fall. And it was the first time that I really began to think about the fact that all of the things that I take for granted, you know, my family, the cities around us, the buildings that I live in, the food that I eat, all of that was really at risk with global warming and other environmental problems. And I began to, or it was in a way the beginning of my social conscience and my understanding of the impact that I was having on the rest of the world and how I could make a difference.
And then things began to evolve from there, and so you ultimately ended up going to Yale.
I did, partly because of the forestry school that Yale has and the sort of strong social activism that was going on there. And I did 2.5 years of school there and ended up being co-chair of the Student Environmental Coalition and planned the first ever big Northeast regional conference on these issues and ended up dropping out to plan it and do follow-through. Thought I would only be out for a semester, but it's been 3.5 years and counting since then, so I really haven't looked back.
Do you plan to go back?
I don't. I don't think so.
Interesting. You found your mission.
I think I have. Mm-hmm. It's certainly worthy of a life's work, and, you know, I've met the best people I know. It's been an incredible challenge. And, no, I love the work, and it surely needs.
You're working primarily with college campus folks. Talk to me about how that interaction is going, what they're talking about, what do you think resonates with them, what doesn't work with them, and also what they think about the broader older environmental community. Because at one point, for example, there were various environmentalists suggesting that environmentalism was dead. That was last year.
Mm-hmm.
Give us an update.
Well, I think it's interesting what's happened in the last 5 or so years within the student environmental movement, in that it has, I think, evolved very quickly, and students have begun moving away from recycling campaigns and river cleanup campaigns, and increasingly are working on global warming, energy issues, and have begun to sort of identify global warming as the primary environmental and economic and societal challenge that we face. And other groups are beginning to get involved in it, too. We've begun to work more closely with other progressive organizations and farm-based groups and groups that are interested in addressing the root causes of war. So it really has become, I think, the hottest environmental issue on college campuses, and has begun to attract other types of organizations as well.
What's the word from the campuses? In other words, in the world out here, that we have this struggle between the red states and the blue states, and we're trying to achieve some sort of awareness on a broader scale that global warming and energy issues matter. And it is happening. We're starting to see this, for example, reflected in certain Congress people who are really championing these issues in a larger way. But when you go to a college campus, are you fighting those same battles yet? Do you have a loyal opposition who is standing again, kind of railing against your concepts?
There really is no opposition on college campuses. I think there is, in many cases, a lack of awareness, although that's improving a lot. But really the major challenge that we've faced in organizing with students is the administrators' sort of concerns about cost. You know, what will it cost the university to buy clean energy or to make their buildings efficient or to transform their transportation systems or how they invest their endowments? It's almost all price concerns, and so we developed a report that's called New Energy for Campuses, which is at our website, campusclimatechallenge.org, and that outlines about 40 case studies of best practices that colleges have done that have not only reduced emissions on the college campuses, but also saved the schools money. So we've really focused our messaging around the idea that this is an economic opportunity that colleges can save huge amounts of money and reduced energy costs by taking on some of the efficiency and transportation and other types of energy and climate policies.
Do you find a fascination or an interest or a bit of energy in really seeing a technological resolution to these problems? You know, in many respects, although there's a cost factor to this, there's also an economic incentive to create these new technologies in the process, creating new companies, new industries, putting people back to work, creating greater efficiencies. What's kind of happening in those realms from the perspective of the college students?
I lived in North Dakota for 4 months at the end of last year because I'm fascinated with new clean energy technologies and the idea of really modernizing our economy based on, you know, ecological concerns, based on new, you know, clean technologies. And you know, I think it's a huge opportunity for the whole country, but I think the Midwest actually is the area of the country that could benefit the most. There are farmers who, you know, could grow fuel and biofuels and create electricity through wind farms. There are a lot of sort of hollowed out Midwest industrial cities that could see a resurgence in jobs in clean tech industries. So I think it's a huge opportunity that right now we're frankly missing out on and are losing the race to many countries around the world in Europe and Asia and other places. So I think our political leaders are doing a pretty bad job right now in benefiting from the transition, which will happen sooner or later. To a clean energy and efficient economy.
As you look out at the broader landscape, and you're very, very fortunate to be working with campuses because there is a lot of discussion. That's where people come to talk about new ideas, to express new visions, to share new ideas that oftentimes it takes quite a while to reach into a more mainstream dialogue. Are there visions or models that you're finding interesting?
I think something that's begun to happen is that colleges are looking at holistic solutions to their emissions problems, and a lot of colleges are beginning to pass comprehensive climate plans and looking systematically at all of the emissions that they create. So they're beginning to identify local food sources to get their food from rather than importing it from abroad, and they're looking at how they invest their endowments and how students and faculty travel to and from the schools and within the school. Also looking at, you know, their buildings and their energy purchases. So that, I think, is exciting, and one of the reasons why I think colleges will be at the center of developing and building a movement is that they are really becoming innovators for sustainability.
How about people that perhaps haven't reached mainstream media currency, leaders, voices, spokespeople, writers, poets, musicians, who you think are making a difference or speaking the message that, that really resonates within your generations?
Yeah. Well, one of my personal heroes is Bill McKibben, who certainly has reached the mainstream in many ways, but he wrote a book that I just got 30 copies of and have been handing out called The Comforting Whirlwind. And, you know, really speaks to the values of our movement. He says that he believes that the secret weapon of environmentalism is that it actually sort of creates a lifestyle that is more pleasurable than consumer-driven lifestyles that our government is promoting. And, you know, I think that that's really true and important for us to consider. There are also leaders like Jahan Giran and Anja Miller who work for the Environmental Justice and Climate Change Initiative, which is a national network of environmental justice groups that are, you know, represent communities that are the first and worst impacted by global warming, and they're sort of reframing the climate movement in terms of justice and rights and making it a moral issue, I think is really critical as well.
Now let's talk about you and your work and where you're really focused now and how you're reaching out. First of all, tell us what you're most involved in right now.
We just launched a campaign called the Campus Climate Challenge, which seeks to engage student groups at over 700 schools around the U.S. and Canada to try to make them models of sustainable communities, to sort of innovate new policies and model them for corporations, cities, other institutions. We did a soft launch of the campaign in October and have 166 campuses involved so far. And so we're supporting them with resources, case studies, helping plan conferences and trainings. We have toolkit for them. So all of that is available at campusclimatechallenge.org, and we're really trying to reach, you know, 500 more schools. So that's what we're working on now.
Mm-hmm. And that's becoming really your full-time endeavor, pretty much.
Yeah, pretty much. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that we also do as a coalition is we plan every, you know, twice a year, really, we plan days of action called, there's one coming up called Fossil Fools Day, which is on April 1st. April Fool's Day.
I think I got that one, yeah. It's great, though, by the way. I just want to say I think it's a great... Oh, what am I trying to say here? There's so much messaging involved in those two words.
Yeah.
Fossil Fools Day. Or three. Three words, actually. Fossil Fools Day. Well, let's talk about Fossil Fools Day. What's going to happen?
Well, you know, we're responding to President Bush's message that America is addicted to oil. And, you know, of course we are. And we've been saying that for a long time. And so, you know, we're glad that he said it, but the solutions that he proposed seemed sort of like a joke.
You mean like nuclear energy?
Yeah, nuclear energy, you know, more research. He's really not proposing solutions that are to scale with the problem. And, you know, in the 5 years that he's been in office, oil imports have increased by 8%. So he's been at the center of our oil addiction and has been, you know, one of the primary or probably the primary pusher of our oil addiction. For him to come out and say that is...
Telling.
Yes, it's telling.
Right. The fact that, God bless him, he finally figured that out is at least encouraging.
It is slightly encouraging. Well, what we're trying to do with the Day of Action is to, you know, in a lighthearted and fun way, poke fun at him and other sort of fossil fools, and then promote real solutions. So, you know, we're talking about real fuel economy standard increases and, you know, transforming university transportation systems, investing in biofuels. So what we're trying to do is show how the solutions that Bush has proposed are false and that we really need real ones.
Well, now you have a lot of activities scheduled around the country. Give us, first of all, some highlights of what is happening.
Well, one of the most effective campaigns that our coalition has been involved in is called the Jumpstart Ford campaign. And the idea is that Ford has the lowest average fuel economy of any major automaker and, like GM, has been suffering and is economically and has had to lay off a number of workers. So we believe that it would be better for Ford and the country if Ford became a real innovator in fuel-efficient cars and trucks. They've begun to sell a few hybrids, but it's still only a very, very small percentage of their fleet. And so we're doing actions at dealerships all across the country, trying to get dealers to sign on to a letter to the company saying that they want the company to make more fuel-efficient cars. We had actions at 160 dealers last Fossil Fools Day. Ford was still a target back then, and we'll have a lot this year again. So that's a real highlight for me.
So if people want to find out what's happening in their community, what's the best way to do so?
They can check www.energyaction.net/fossilfools or jumpstartford.org.
How many people are you expecting to participate this Fossil Fools Day?
Well, we're expecting somewhere between 100 and 200 actions this Fossil Fools Day.
Mm-hmm.
We never know how many will come.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you a question, and that's really kind of fun, and it is action, but it does take friendly action to sometimes, you know, bring about some sort of wake up call to people that otherwise may just go along with the status quo. Some people don't like that, and that's fine too. It takes all kinds for change. That's one thing I'm well aware of.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think about Ford? What is it? Why don't they get it when so many other car companies around the world are? You know, General Motors is about ready to lay off or retire 125,000 people, but that's a lot of people that suddenly lose their jobs. And it is so much because the cars themselves just aren't meeting what most everybody here is wanting. What do you think is behind this, behind Ford's inability? There's so many different angles to this, so many different stories about what causes this, but from your perspective, what do you think is the root?
Yeah, it's a complex thing, but I think that there are a couple things going on, one of which is that the government really isn't sending the proper signals. They aren't incentivizing making cleaner cars the way they should be. Another is that a lot of their profit margins, or they have much higher profit margins on the SUVs and the trucks that they sell. So it's still much more profitable for them to make SUVs than cars and trucks, although they could change that if they, you know, began to really innovate and make cars and trucks that people wanted to buy. I think a third and maybe the biggest reason is that a lot of these companies are stuck in a very short-term way of thinking because of their stock prices and, you know, investors are stuck in a quarterly reporting model that makes it harder for them to plan long term and invest in products that, you know, won't come down the line for a little bit longer but might save the company in the long term.
As you look out into the future, I mean, what you're suggesting, and I totally agree, is the fact that there's this overemphasis on the short-term profitability with almost a total lack of real concern about the real issues. It's one thing to make short-term profits, but here's General Motors going down the tubes because they haven't taken a long-term vision. So ultimately, profitability is destroyed. What are your hopes that somehow our system is going to integrate a more balanced approach to integrating economics and our resource bases and jobs. Do you expect that to happen? And if so, how do you think it might come about?
You know, I think it really is going to be on the government to do it. I think it'll take policies to change the way capitalism works. You know, I'm not confident that in the short term we will move to a system other than capitalism, but I think we need a government that really is working to address the problems that come out of the current economic model that we work in. And right now, it's, you know, government is sitting by and watching as these problems get worse. And so I think it'll take real political leadership, which we don't have very much of right now.
Well, Billy Parrish, I want to thank you, first of all, for lending your voice to the Wild Side News.
Yeah, happy to. Thanks.
Yeah, and I wish you great success. And, you know, quite honestly, I'm happy you're involved because you bring a lot of hope to me when you suggest, for example, that on campuses people are really getting it. That's really great. That's
a huge movement is building. Very exciting.
Billy Parrish, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Sydney.
Hope you enjoyed our Fools, Foundations, and Festivals features. There's so much happening around the planet, and there's no easier way to keep informed than by tuning in each Thursday or anytime on the archives. This is Sydney Wildsmith saying adios until we meet again when your voice of the earth returns here on the Wild Side News.